big
So it's
tip.
basically be true to yourself. It's being true to who you really are. I mean, once again, it sounds like some awful kid's story from Disney, but having lost my soul and rebuilt it, I know how phenomenally difficult it is to build a soul in inverted commas or get a soul back.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion, and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips, how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. Jason Barnard was born in Leeds and was brought up in a tiny, lonely, remote village on the Yorkshire Moors. As you've just heard, he has a lovely Yorkshire accent. Now, not a lot happens in a small village of 25 people, especially for a punk fan. So he moved to Liverpool, where he was allowed to be who he wanted to be, and he joined a blues band called Stanley the Counting Horse. And in 1987, they played the Cavern Club, that of the Beatles fame. And while he was there in Liverpool, he graduated John Moore University with a BA in Economics with a specialisation in Statistical Analysis. As you will hear in our chat, Jason is a man that has chased wild life experiences, and he's full of amazing stories. There are lots of interesting, strange connections to UK 80s pop heroes. At the age of 21, he was finished with Liverpool and got a better offer to play and travel. We needed a double bass player. If you can learn to play bass in 30 days, you can join the band. He learned to play the bass in a two-hour session, and his tutor gave him some valuable wisdom and some great metaphors for living life. Playing double bass started his 10-year career in a folk punk band and drinking beer. Now, life on the road was travelling to gigs and busking en route to the next gig. They moved around from Paris, Belgium, Amsterdam, Zurich and Italy, making a good living. After 9+ years, a 1,000,000 kilometres on the road, 600 gigs, 3,000 street appearances, the band just stopped and the party was over. The band fizzled out as they left to find new direction, and Jason was left wondering what next. Jason started writing music for children, and the record industry did not really see his visions, so going it alone, his wife Veronique created cartoon characters to sing the songs, a blue dog and a yellow koala. It was 1998 and they built a successful online business with Booa and Koala before YouTube. And by 2007 they had over 5 million views a month and it led to a TV series. Oh, did I mention he moved the family from Paris to Mauritius? The Blue Dog journey lasted 10 years and in 2008 it ended in disagreement with his business partner. This followed court cases, frustration, depression and loss of income, and it was tough on Jason and the family. Jason had lost the business and he was stuck in Mauritius with nothing. His only option was remote working. In his journey with web development for the Blue Dog project, he'd learnt lots of digital skills and so became a web and SEO consultant. Our conversation explores Jason's journey over 30 years in 10-year jumps. He is a wonderful storyteller, and this conversation is very much in two parts. In his words, the first part will be the bonkers mad person, and part two will be the digital marketer. That is not a fair description of our conversation. It is a beautiful journey of a man playing the game of life, learning loads of stuff and reinventing himself along the way. We learn how he dealt with depression and the tools he used to keep his mental health. We touch on some of the raw nerves, and I so appreciate his willingness to talk about it. The point is, losing the blue dog was like having his soul ripped out. And while that part of his life is gone forever, he still has countless memories and heartwarming stories to share. Today, Jason is at the top of his game in SEO and has a podcast dedicated to the subject. So in addition to his wild and varied lifestyle, he has also created some unique management systems to influence how Google reflects the business. He is known as the Brand SERP Guy and now becoming known for his work in knowledge panels. It's all technical stuff and not for us mortals, but if you are a digital agency serving clients, Jason is the man to speak to. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Jason Barnard. So today I am with Jason Barnard. Now, I know a few bits about him. I know he was a character in a cartoon, a music cartoon. I also know he's into SEO, but we'll get to that bit later because I'm sure there's all sorts of exciting bits in the middle. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for turning up and saying hi. What's going on in your end of the world?
Well, thank you for having me, Paul. It's delightful to be here. I'm delighted to talk about cartoon characters, SEO, and everything in the middle. I'm in Paris. It's nice and sunny. We're about to go into lockdown, but, you know, life isn't too bad.
Overall. We've done it for a year now. We're all used to these sort of things. So, and it'll probably become a way of life, I suspect, over the next few years in, out. But who knows?
Shaking it all about.
Indeed. A British man living in Paris.
Seeing the okie cokie.
Yes, indeed. We're obviously of a similar age. So tell me, this is life, passion and business, and it all started somewhere for you. And it obviously didn't start in Paris, by the sounds of it, your voice. You come from the land here. Whereabouts are you from? What's the story?
Well, I was born in Leeds and I was brought up in a tiny village called Denton of 25 people, in fact, High Denton, on the Yorkshire Moors. In a tiny, tiny, tiny village surrounded by cows and sheep and farmers and very lonely upbringing. I went to school in a town called Otley, which is big on rugby and big on fights and big on general kind of violence and mutual torture between children. Didn't much like that, as you can guess. And then moved to Liverpool, which was amazing. And it was kind of one of these moments in life. I was a punk when I was in Otley. And went to Liverpool and realised I didn't need to be a punk because in Liverpool, I felt Liverpool was great because I was allowed to be who I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I felt Liverpool was very welcoming. They called me the woolly back because I came from sheep country. But it was in a kind of friendly way. I found Liverpool to be welcoming and open-armed. And it was really like, you know, all right, mate, you can come be whoever you want. That's my really crap Liverpool accent.
Well, for my audience, it's probably quite a good Liverpool audience accent, so don't worry.
Liverpool's ace. I loved Liverpool. Had a few traumas there, as I told you. Played in a band, played the Cavern Club, went to the same university.
Hang on a minute. The Cavern Club. Didn't that close and reopen, the Cavern Club? For anyone who didn't realise, because we're men of a certain age, you see, we know the Cavern Club is where the Beatles played, but... So when were you playing the Cavern Club?
Ooh, this was 1987.
Because didn't it reopen or something years later?
It got knocked down and then they rebuilt it with some of the same bricks, but they rebuilt it exactly the same. So you got that standard kind of, the maybe not the vibe, but certainly kind of the idea of what it would have been like. And to be honest with you, it doesn't make me a better or more important person, but playing the Cavern Club when you're an aspiring musician, it's just, you go, yeah, how many people can say that in the entire world?
Well, indeed, it's a badge, isn't it? It's a badge you can say, I played the Cavern Club. It's like any badge you can have, you know, it's like, the thing. Very few people can put that on their CV, can they?
and it's kind of one of the things, and I think that's an important part of life, is it's an experience. Yeah. And a lot of the stuff I've got in life or I've done in life is just saying, well, why not? I mean, it's something I can do that will change something in my existence. And playing the Cavern Club, good, bad, medium, in the middle, brilliant, amazing.
So were you the singer, the guitarist or the bass player?
It was a blues band called Stanley the Counting Horse, named after the Liverpool police horse that could count, which was very silly. Because I had an Irish friend who's insisted that we call it Stanley the Counting Horse, and we were foolish enough just to agree. And I was the singer. And here's a good story. I was the singer. A guy called Dave from Dewsbury was the guitar player, and the drummer was Ben Gunn from the Sisters of Mercy.
Okay.
who was the guitarist in the Sisters of Mercy, who wrote the riff for the song Alice. He left the Sisters of Mercy, went to Liverpool, and joined a second-rate blues band playing the snare drum. And I love him for it.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, well, there you go. Claims to fame and all these claims. So what happened to your music career? Did it take off?
Not in Liverpool, no. Liverpool was, we played CD bars for pints of beer with people playing pool. It was a real rootsy kind of, you know, playing bars where people didn't really want you to play. The audience just wasn't there. Nobody cared.
Such fun, I imagine.
It teaches you to make your own fun, as it were, like a kid. You know, you kind of say, well, if nobody else is going to care, I might as well have a good time doing it. And that was interesting. But then I moved to Paris and joined a proper band, as it were, playing in the street, busking. And it sounds weird saying a proper band, but we made a decent living busking in Paris and Berlin and Amsterdam and a lot in Zurich. And I met these guys and they said, oh, you're a nice guy. Do you want to join the band? And they were actually very, 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 very good before I joined.
Right.
And I said, yeah, I can sing and play a bit of guitar. And they said, well, we don't need a singer. We've got all four of us can sing. We've got a guitar player. We need a double bass player.
All right.
And I said, oh, I don't play the double bass. And they said, well, if you learn to play the double bass in 30 days, we've got a gig. And if you nail that gig, you're in the band and you can come with us.
How can they pick you like this? It's a strange audition for a band.
Yeah, well, my mate lived in a flat with one of them and he dragged me down to one of their gigs and I got really, 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 really drunk. And they said to my mate, your mate Jace seems like a fun guy. He fits in with the band's kind of outlook, which is to get really drunk and play folk punk music.
Yeah.
If he wants to join the band, he can. And it was basically because I got incredibly drunk and they knew I played a bit of music and I'd been in bands before. We have great qualifications to be in a band, of course.
I guess you were all young.
Yeah, I was 21, something like that.
Oh, well, brilliant. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
So I actually went and bought a double bass, literally. I went in and the guy said, here's the double bass. I saw one for sale. He said, here's the double bass. Do you want to try it out? I was going, I don't even know what to do with it. So I kind of went away without playing double bass. And interestingly, I'll quickly leap to the future. It's the double bass I still have. And it turns out it was a very good one. I was incredibly lucky. And then I went back to Paris. I said, all right, guys, I've got the double bass. Here you go. And they went, oh, right. I think they were quite surprised. Because, you know, it was 500 quid, 500 pounds, 500 euros, whatever it would be. Which when you're 21 years old and just moved to a new city, that's a lot of money. And they said, okay. And I said, well, I don't know how to play. And they said, right, what we'll do is we're going to get this double bass, a German double bass player called Franz, and he'll give you a two-hour lesson.
Right.
And what they did was exchange with him the busking spot in Paris, the best one, we called them pitches, for a day. They gave up their turn on the best spot to this guy. And in exchange, he gave me a two-hour lesson. And he was tiny. He was, you know, like 5'4". And for double bass players, being tiny is a disadvantage.
Yeah.
And he was so good.
Because they're big things, aren't they, double basses? And they're heavy.
Yeah. Charlie Mingus, I think it was, said it's 80% physically dominating the instrument, 20% talent, which suits me fine. And this guy was absolutely amazing. And he taught me the slap, the double slap. He taught me how to hold it. He taught me this, which is the finger movement, which allows you to play for hours on end without getting tired because it's so big. And this, that movement, which you can't see if you're not
for the benefit of my listeners, that means nothing. But there we go.
And then you sit in the metro and you do this, and this is the exercise you have to do to keep yourself on form. And okay, as you can see, I can still do it all these years later. And then what was interesting, I like this story because it's a great lesson in life, I think, is he said, right, when you're playing the double bass, you have to remember what it is you're doing. You're keeping the rhythm, making the bridge between the drums and the rest of the instruments. All anybody cares about is that you're in time with both of them, or you're making that bridge. So you have to hit the bass in time from beginning to end. And that's your main job. You do that, number one. Number two, if you play a bum note, remember, you're going to freak out and you're going to think about it and you're going to think, that was crap and everyone's going to hear and I'm going to look awful and it's going to be terrible. A, you've got to forget it immediately. And if you can forget it, the rest, what's going to come isn't going to be affected by what happened. So you have to get rid of that thought so that it doesn't destroy what comes next. Thirdly, there are two types of people in the audience, musicians and non-musicians. And you go, okay, great. And he said, non-musicians have no idea what you just did. So they don't know it was a bum note. And musicians, really, the jazz musicians, will think you've done something really clever and they won't dare ask you about it because they'll think you're going to make them look stupid. So you don't care what they think because nobody will actually ever confront you with it. And the third thing is always smile, always look like you're having fun and you're doing a good job. And that was it. Three pieces of advice. And I nailed the first gig.
Sounds perfect to me. Sounds brilliant. Yep.
It was stunning. And in fact, to be honest with you, but actually I was going to say, to be honest with you, one piece of advice was a bit more important than the others, but that's not true. Looking like you know what you're doing is incredibly important. Having a minimum of talent for what you're doing is incredibly important. And not worrying about what other people think is incredibly important.
It's a bit like podcasting. We've been doing it for 3 years now. No one's guessed. So it's fantastic.
There you go.
There you go.
I agree. That's brilliant.
So did the music career last?
10 years, maybe.
Oh, wow. So you travelled all over the world or just all over Europe?
It was really, really just Europe. In fact, it was just Europe. We bought a van and we toured around playing gigs in bars and festivals and in the street. We basically played in the street when we didn't have any money and then played bars and gigs because we thought we were going to be rock stars and play stadiums. We played Milan on the same day. In fact, we played Milan in this tiny bar and it was great. We had to play 3 days in the street in order to be able to afford the trip to Milan to play one evening in a bar that paid us an absolute pittance. And when we turned up to play the bar, there were less people watching us in the bar than had been watching us in the street the last 3 days each time. And it turned out U2 were playing the stadium right next door. So everyone was at the U2 gig. So, and you can never tell. And we traveled 100,000 kilometers a year in this van for 8 or 9 years. And then another year of before when we weren't actually traveling very much, but that was a lot of mileage to play a lot of gigs. And what I like about it, looking back in retrospect as kind of the older version of me, is that we were completely convinced that we were going to be rock stars and playing stadiums. And looking back, you're saying, how naive is that? But then if you didn't believe it, you wouldn't do it. It's the only thing that keeps you going. So we played, I think it was 600 gigs, proper gigs, and 3,000 or 4,000 times in the street over that period of time to make a living. And it was cool. And we played a festival with Bob Dylan. We played with the Pogues, played with the Mano Negra. I played with Captain Sensible. For people who aren't of our age, he used to be the guitar player in the Damned and then did some pretty silly songs on Top of the Pops for years. And we played a gig with him in Germany in, I can't remember what town, in 1993 or 94. And he had measles, so we couldn't actually even meet him. We met him. We saw him, obviously, but he was hiding in his dressing room and told us not to come in because he had measles.
And you've got those stories. I mean, it just goes to prove sometimes the outcome's not important. It's the journey that matters.
Oh, you're very Japanese. Yeah, I agree, 100%. The thing is, all of these memories, and it is interesting kind of doing these podcasts now, the stories themselves and the path to where I ended up is much more interesting than where I am or where I at any given moment. The living of it, the pathway, the journey is really what's important. And it's really difficult to remember when you're actually on the journey because you're impatient to get to the destination.
Mm. Especially when you're youthful, when you're young, you kind of want it all now. So was this a passion? I mean, the music must have been a passion for you. Was it the craving, the success of stardom and limousines and champagne and stuff?
Actually, playing in the band in the 90s, it was all about the fact that I was allowed to drink loads of beer while I was working. And I thought that was really cool. And that the people owned the bar would say, you have to drink lots of beer. And being encouraged to drink beer by your employer is pretty cool. And also, I thought we were going to be stars. And another interesting thing is that I ended up playing with three of the best musicians I've ever seen, heard, or, I mean, it's not just that I've played with, but three of the best musicians I've seen. The singer sings like he breathes. I mean, it gives me goosebumps just saying kind of wow. The mandolin player used to play this incredible riff behind his head on the mandolin. And he could pick up any instrument and play something decent on it straight off.
Are there any recordings or YouTubes of this that we could see?
Yeah, there are four albums. Oh, if you go to YouTube and look at The Barking Dogs, The Ace of Spades, we did a version of The Ace of Spades, the Motorhead song. And, you know, I'm in the band, but it's not.
I'm definitely going to post those links. Those links will definitely be on the podcast because it's fascinating. Because when you start saying something like that, it's like they've got to be listened to. So I will put those links in.
Yeah, well, and that's it, is that I think I can say, I think that we really, really rocked it. I mean, it was really, it's solid, it's fast, it's punky, folky, and it isn't because I'm in it, but I was part of it, and I'm very proud to have been part of it. But when you listen to the singer and you look at his face, he's bonkers, deep down, he's bonkers, but he just has this thing. The mandolin player, you're going, how does he do that? I'm standing there playing double bass, and keeping time, I'm in time. You can see that I really took Franz's words to heart, and I'm knocking it out. And then the drummer, guy called Marcus Godwin, absolutely nuts guy and incredibly good. Yeah, I mean, so good. I mean, I'm lost for words. And the thing was, it was all of us were very, very good at the thing we had to do.
Yeah,
and all of us, for some reason, it gelled. And I mean, when I think about that, I think, you know, I think I was going to say deserve, but that's not fair. It would have been such a lovely thing to have been successful, because I think it would have been positive not only for us, but for the world.
It would have been a different journey, because that's the journey you're on. The journey is the struggle you were on, you know, and then if it had been successful, it would have been another journey. There would have been another chapter to the conversation, wouldn't there? That's how it would have been. So obviously it lasted for 10 years, and then you went on to do other things. Well, what happened? Did you make a decision to break apart, or what happened? You all got serious and started settling down?
No, what I'm now kind of retrospectively a little bit disappointed about is they all left because they thought that it wasn't going anywhere, which it probably wasn't. But I ended up standing on my own thinking, where have all the band members gone? It was me. And we had a joke in the band, is what would be the worst possible audience? And we all agreed, kids, that would be the worst. And then I kind of ended the band, or the band stopped. And I thought, what am I going to do now? And I started writing songs, and I thought, that sounds like something a kid would listen to. So I started trying to write kids songs. And I was a bit embarrassed, to be honest, because I've been kind of saying, oh, I don't want to play for kids. And it turned out deep down, I think I probably did. And I just wanted to agree with everybody else so that we didn't have a fight. And I wrote these songs and then took them around the record companies. And they said, you can't do kids songs. You're a folk punk musician. You're not having that. So I couldn't get any record company to sign them on. So I recorded them myself in my house, and still they didn't want it. So my wife drew some characters, cartoon characters, that we then turned into a website using Flash in 1998. And we launched basically what it was at the time was a CD-ROM online for kids based on children's songs sung by a blue dog and a yellow koala.
Sounds Why brilliant. Not? Did it work?
Yeah, we ended up with 5 million visits a month and 100 million page views in 2007.
Did the local companies come knocking at that point?
By that time, I'd built a company. We'd moved to Mauritius to do all of this. And the company did very, very, very well. And we ended up making a TV series with ITV International. So the record companies didn't matter anymore to me.
Indeed. Mauritius, really? That's another journey. Gosh, this is such a rich conversation with you. I mean, is this being driven by, what's this being driven by? Because it's always, you know, I always come back to passion and purpose at the end of the day. Where's the driver for you?
To be honest with you, I don't really know. All of it was, I really want to do this, and I really think this is going to be good. And I'm confident that I'm doing it with people who will make it really good. And that is valuable to the world. And if I do it, it will be a positive contribution to the world and make me happy doing it. And if I get that kind of combination together, I just don't give up. And the other thing, moving to Mauritius, it's just kind of, it was in 1998 and or 99, and people were saying you can do the internet from anywhere. It was the beginning of the internet, and people going, wow, you can do it from anywhere, but nobody was. And I thought, oh, all right, where should we do it from? And my wife, we were in Paris. She was a little bit ill, and we had a young daughter. And we decided we needed to get out of Paris. And the choice was south of France or the other side of the world. And my personality is punk, as I've been since I was living with the cows in the countryside. Yeah, if I shouldn't do it, I'm definitely going to give
Mauritius
it a go.
Mauritius sounds like... Mauritius won, yeah, obviously, yes. When, given
it's
that choice.
It's exciting.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
It's exciting and different and slightly edgy and a bit dangerous, and it's something that most people wouldn't...
One of my other podcast guests actually did something similar to set up some of that, and because when he got to that location, there was no internet.
We had that problem. We did have internet, but that is actually a problem. You don't think about it. And what is surprising is how many obvious things you don't think about beforehand. And that was the first one, is you turn up and we had 64K internet and it cost us €1,000 a month. That's insane. So we moved to a really kind of tropical island where everything's supposed to be cheap to run this website, and ended up paying an absolute fortune. Most of the money from the company in the first years went to paying the internet connection to actually be able to put the site online. And the other problem is I moved there with this kind of internet site. I was the blue dog, writing the songs and making the games and writing the stories with my wife. And I moved to Mauritius and we were going to employ developers to build the platform, to deliver the content, and run the servers and distribute it all and all that techie stuff. And we turned up in Mauritius and I advertised for a developer. And the applicants, one of them turned up and said, I know a bit of Excel. And that's not development. That's not web development. That's not programming. That's office work. And what I then realized is I was in trouble, in inverted commas, in the sense that we didn't have the people available to be able to do this work.
Yeah.
So a couple of things came out of that, both of which I found interesting. Is I found, obviously I'm exaggerating in that there was nobody. We did find some people and they were writing this PHP code, you know, script server code things,
yeah,
and MySQL. And I was looking at the code and I think that can't be right. That looks really weird. I mean, it doesn't look like it's sensible at all. And I bought a book from Amazon, had it delivered to Mauritius, and it took like 3 weeks to get there or whatever it would be, and read it over a weekend. And then went back into work and sat down with the developer and said, right, here's the book I've read. Here's the bits I've marked out. Here's what I think we should be doing. Here's what you're doing. Can we try and make it match a bit more? And over the next few months, actually, it was an interesting experience because I would read at the weekend, then come back in and we'd sit down with the developer and rework how it was all built. So I ended up learning how to develop alongside somebody I would say had talent for development, but just didn't have the experience. And so kind of we learned together and it was absolutely lovely.
But you're not alone on this. Cause I mean, one of my other podcast guests, the grass guy, he ended up developing a lawnmower app, like it's a bit like Uber for lawn care in the States.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so you can, you know, so that's what it is. It's like the Uber drivers are the grass cutters. But right. I mean, but it took him 10 years to develop the flipping app because like they employed people and it was crap. And eventually ended up the team of them, him and his partners, sit down to make it themselves in the day because they couldn't get anyone to make it properly for them. And that was in the US.
Good point. Yeah, I think that there is that kind of whole thing. I was talking to somebody about it earlier on, is that when you're developing that kind of thing, you say, well, this is what I want to do. But you don't know what the restrictions are in terms of technology. You don't know what the opportunities are in the technology. And you're guessing. And if you do it yourself, you can adapt along the way.
I think that's the thing about creators have, isn't it? I mean, I think when you've got a real clear sense of what you want, what you're trying to achieve, trying to communicate that and getting a techie person to take that idea and make it yours is really difficult. Because like, yeah, but it works out, you know, but that's not how I want it to work. Yeah, but that's how it works. You know, if they don't see that connection. Mm. My wife is similar. She is the kind of creative thing around websites and systems. Mm. And she gets so frustrated with software that won't do what she wants it to do. So I know exactly what you mean by that.
100%. And the other thing is that what you thought would be the right way to do it turns out not to be the right way to do it, and you need to change course. And it's not major changing, of course. It's just adapting to the reality that actually appears as you go through the process.
Yeah.
And when you're working through a developer, that's very difficult to do because you don't see what's happening in the yeah. deep kind of dark holes of the code itself.
So look, you got this working by the sounds of it, and you obviously rose to the challenges of living in what is essentially a third world country on some level, I guess.
Yep.
And yeah, you made it
I
work.
Mean, well, yeah, kind of third world country, but kind of not really. I mean, it's part of Africa.
Yeah.
So it's an African nation. But it dominated by the Indian community that the English colonialists brought in from India, with a French community from the French colonial
But it's like a country with, you know, which is aspirational, but it doesn't quite have the infrastructure to that you're expecting, that you're used to. So you made it work by the sounds of it.
Yeah, no, yeah, 100%. We managed it, and it was a struggle at times. I mean, I remember when the server crashed, and the other thing is we were dealing with children. And children don't understand that the site is down or the developer's got flu, so he can't do it. He can't actually build the content for this. Because we would update with new games, songs, and stories on the first day of every month.
Right.
And I was at the end of the production line because I was doing all the kind of putting the games in place and putting them online. So I would, every last day of the month, I would spend all night just updating and making sure it was all in place for the kids when they woke up in the morning, as it were. And that was a really good lesson in reliability, being reliable, being consistent. Because if I missed one, we would get literally hundreds of emails from parents very frustrated because their kids were frustrated. Mm. And as parents, it's very difficult to explain to your child that something they expected or had been promised did not turn up.
Yeah.
And they blame their parents. They don't blame me. And so kind of through both sympathy for the parents and their situation, also because we didn't want to receive 100 emails in the day, you got it done. And that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. So how long did that last? How long were you a cartoon character?
10 years.
Okay. Another 10 years. This is becoming a theme.
it is actually, because the next 10 years I was an SEO consultant, and I've now moved into a slightly different field, so it does seem to be kind of cycles of 10 years.
Fair enough. So what happened then? What made you, obviously now back in Paris, did you leave Mauritius for a reason, or what brought you back to
Yeah, well, a bit like the band, everybody left. Well, actually, my business partner, I made the mistake as a creative-y kind of a person who's very naive, and I was a blue dog. I actually went a little bit mad, I think, because I got so into being the blue dog that me and the blue dog became the same thing. And I honestly think I went a little bit loopy. And he took advantage of that, in my opinion. And took the company, basically, and pushed me out, at which point I had to find another career. So the site is still going. The cartoon still exists. And he's just making a hash of making anything decent out of it. It's quite depressing to see how we had, as I said, 5 million visits, 100 million page views a month in 2007. I don't know how many there are now, but the site is falling apart. It's desperately depressing.
Yeah. I mean, hear that, a few things like that. I mean, like, I think in Dyson's early work, I mean, he's early wheelbarrow and bits and pieces he had. He was stitched up by someone on that one.
Yeah. I mean, it's that thing. I mean, I tried to explain it to my business partner in these terms, but he didn't understand. I mean, maybe because he doesn't come from the north of England, but it was that thing of the little posh kid who couldn't play football, who owned the football, and wanted to make up the rules and wanted to be the centre forward. And then when you said, you're not going to be the centre forward because we've got a really good centre forward, you can play left midfield or whatever it might be. They got in a real strop and said, if I can't be centre forward and score all the goals, I'm taking my ball and going home. And it's that kind of sulky thing. And then he takes the ball and goes home and he sits on his own with his football. And you go, well, now what am I going to do? And that's the point, is they don't know what to do with what they've got.
Yeah.
but they want it anyway, and they're willing to take it away from everybody else out of whatever motivation they have. And you just say, you end up sitting in the corner on your own with your football, ruining everybody else's pleasure because you want to be the center.
Well,
the star,
I guess that's the point, isn't it? Everyone's on a journey, and that's their journey, and we can't. And
oh, good point. I saw. I was just getting quite upset about that. But yes, you've just after 15 years, I've just realised that I should just say, go on your journey with your football, sitting in your
house.
That's
all you can
do
in the day. You know, if they don't want to play with you, that's you just. So obviously, you had to go and find a new job because the blue dog. You got lost your blue dog. So what happened next?
Well, I was stuck in Mauritius, basically abandoned in Mauritius, as it were, as a blue dog. And I had to find a way to make a living. And basically, I just pitched for work in the UK remotely in order to make the money to be able to move back.
Yep.
And pitch said, you know, I built a website for kids, 5 million visits a month, 1 million visits from Google a month. If I can do that for a kid's site, think what I can do for your company.
Yep.
And turned it into an SEO career, which lasted for about 10 years, I suppose.
Is that what sort of date was that?
2008. Late 2008, I started, and then it took me 3 years to make the money to uproot and come back to Paris with the family.
Wow.
And it's quite difficult restarting. I mean, that's an interesting point as well that I hadn't really thought about. Is starting from, well, restarting rather, as remote worker in 2007, 2008 was actually pretty difficult because people expected to actually meet you.
Mm.
And pitching to people and working with them long term without being able to meet them at that time was really quite difficult to, it was a difficult trick to play.
I'm impressed that you did it, actual fact, that, and also that you, because it's like being pushed out like that and give, you know, and having your toys taken away like that in a way, and being told, and well, it's not just your toys, it's your livelihood. And it's not just your livelihood, it's your family's livelihood. That must have been a real blow. That must have been really, really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't tell that story very often. I mean, obviously I got... I know what depression is. I know what clinical depression is. I've been there. That was probably one of the reasons it took so long.
Yeah.
I got dragged through the courts, through countless court cases that cost me an absolute fortune. It wasn't just trying to rebuild a career. It was trying to rebuild a career whilst pulling myself out of depression and also paying heavy court bills, because part of the strategy, I believe, was if we can bankrupt him, we can get it all.
The thing I took it
very personally, and it
well
isn't personal,
I'm not surprised business. And there's no reason why you shouldn't take it personally, because at the end of the day, that's what, you know, that's when people go for you like that, there's obviously a personal aspect to it.
But I agree. I have the right to, I'm not rubbish for having done that, but it isn't helpful in terms of actually getting out of the situation.
No, it's not helpful, but it's also very hard no one goes to that without suffering the, you know, taking the blows, did they?
No, 100%. I mean, I think all of these kind of stories, it is really a story about starting, building, getting somewhere. It all falls apart very quickly. I mean, the band splitting up was literally kind of like a few weeks. And then starting to rebuild something else. And one of the interesting things is as it's just finished, you kind of think, what am I going to do now? And that's this big empty moment, which is probably the worst of all of them, is you're going, I don't know what I want to do. So you start doing something and you realize you're not that motivated. You can't get yourself to do it. And that period of kind of thinking, what's going to be next? Usually, well, I'm going to generalize here, usually lasts about a year for me. And that's a really difficult period because it feels like I'm not going anywhere. And I think that's maybe part of the motivation you were talking about earlier, is I'm motivated if I'm going somewhere.
What tools did you use to pull yourself out of it? Because this is, you know, big stuff. People are, you know.
A lot of determination, a lot of getting up in the morning and thinking, well, I'm not going to let it beat me. Sounds a bit kind of, I don't know, American-y, self-motivationally thingy, but I mean, you go up in the morning and you think, I really, 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 really can't face this. And you just say, I have to face it. Because I mean, and that's the other thing, as I had a wife and child. My wife was obviously capable of working, but we were in Mauritius. In Mauritius, as you said, it's an aspiring third world country. Getting a job in Mauritius that pays any decent money is very difficult. So obviously that remote work comes into play. So kind of it was a question of saying, well, I need to get up. I need to make this work because I need to fend, or I need to provide for myself and for my family. I need to also get myself back on track because I can't spend my days moping around looking miserable and trying to figure out what it is I'm going to do. And what was kind of quite another hard hit was that we then created two more cartoon characters. And our business partner created a trademark in the US of something we had created and then said to the Mauritian courts, this is my copyright, they have to stop. So he actually kind of started trying to create, what he was doing created a situation where it was very difficult for me to restart something creative because of that danger. And Mauritius, great though it is as a country, I wouldn't like, well, I know, I don't want to go anywhere near the court system there.
No, a lot of them have, yeah, I can hear what you, I mean, you're very amazing that you're not more bitter than you actually, you could.
Oh,
could
I was.
yes, I can imagine. You know, but the thing about bitterness and anger and these sort of stuff, it's like, you know, because the trouble with it is, it's like, how's it phrased? It's like drinking poison yourself and hating someone else for it. I mean, you know, it's more toxic to you than it is to the person you're hating.
Well, oh, that's a very interesting point. Sorry, because one thing that I used a lot is I read loads of Confucius. I mean, there isn't a lot of Confucius to read. You just have to reread the same book over and over and over again.
Yeah, sure.
The fundamental basics of Confucius are pretty simple. But I find it very useful kind of to read it. And one of the things Confucius says is don't go, well I'm paraphrasing obviously because he wouldn't have said it quite like this. Don't go on and on and on about it to everybody you meet because A, bulls pants off people. But B, every time you tell it again, you're bringing it all to the surface and you're vomiting this entire story and it's poisoning you, which is what made me think of that again. Yeah. And as soon as you can manage to stop talking about it all the time, you will stop poisoning yourself and you will start to be able to pull out. I'm paraphrasing in a very, very blasé manner. And I found that because when you're in that kind of situation, when you're really, really, really in a bad place in your brain, you want to talk about it incessantly because it's the only thing you can think about. And you become so self-obsessed that the only thing that should interest anyone in the entire universe is my story and my miserable, miserable situation. And they should listen to me moan about it for hours. And people will. And then after a while, they get bored and they kind of move away and you stop seeing them so much and you wonder why. And you realize that not only do they get bored of it, but you're getting bored of your own stupid story. And forcing yourself to stop talking about it is possibly the best advice I gave myself. And once I stop talking about it, it doesn't disappear straight away, but it certainly gets better.
It's fascinating how these conditions are so similar. You know, it's like, you know, that you, at the end of the day, the gates of change are locked on the inside. Only we can choose when we are ready to move forward or change in anything. And what you just mentioned to me about people getting bored, it's the same around grief. So when someone dies, and now this is horrendous, I know, but someone dies, close, you talk about it to your friends and family. So my father did this. My father spoke about my mum dying for months and months and months and months and months. Now, it was okay for the first month. It was okay for the second month. But after the second month, we'd all moved on, but he hadn't. And he couldn't move on. And so what he would do is try and find people that would support him in that conversation so he could keep talking about it. So, and it's really, and I know it's, you know, there are techniques and means of getting over this. And you sound like you found Confucius was yours, but there's always a process for this.
Yeah, well, actually, it was an interesting situation in Mauritius because we lived in a small village on the seaside. And there was a little supermarket. And literally three times people came up to me, Jason, I've heard that you've got a certain number of problems. Could we have a chat? And I would end up just talking to people and they say, like, how did you get out of this situation? How did you deal with that? And it was actually really interesting because the tips and tricks I found turned out to help other people. And one of them that I found spectacularly helpful was that people who have, for example, agoraphobia and other fear-based problems, very, 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 very difficult to deal with. I've been there, not for an extensive period, but I actually talked to my GP, who was turned out to be an incredibly smart, very, very kind guy who helped enormously. And he explained to me why it happened. Then he explained to me how you can start to stop it happening. And I found that understanding of the physical reasons behind it helped me to deal with the functional question. Mm. So basically what happens is you have a negative thought or a fearful thought. You think, oh, that scared me. You get a shot of an adrenaline that lasts 20 seconds. If within that 20 seconds you have another fearful thought, there will be another shot of adrenaline.
Right.
If within that 20 seconds you've got another, and so on. And what happens is it piles up and piles up and piles up. And your body can get rid of the adrenaline in 20 seconds. But if it gets another shot before it gets rid of the first lot, it's accumulating. And what then happens is you get this accumulation of adrenaline that makes you feel increasingly fearful. So it worsens the fear problem. And at one point, your whole body is just freaking out. And when you faint, and this is what he said. It's not, you think you're going to die.
Yes.
But actually what it is, it's your brain is switching off your body because otherwise you will die.
Yes.
So your brain just goes, I'm overriding this entire fucking lot. And it closes your body down.
Yes.
You faint and it saves your life. So if you look at that faint moment as saving your life and not as death, which people who have panic attacks, I'm obviously generalizing, but there is a tendency for that. It's actually saving your life and not the opposite.
Yeah.
And so A, you can get rid of that ultimate fear, which is the fainting moment. And B, you can say, my short-term aim is to keep calm for 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And that goal, if you manage to do it once, you know you can do it twice. And if you can do it twice, you know, and so on and so forth. And it doesn't work every time and you've got to accept. And that's the other thing is, you know, two steps forward, one step back. That kind of process is really
important. It's about building stronger connections into the positive and weakening the power and the bond of those weaker connections, those negative connections. And I really, really understand, really, really resonate with some of that stuff.
That one thing about the 20 seconds, just to finish that, it is really for me. And this is just for me, so I can't actually say, well, this will work for anybody else or everybody else. But for me, it was understanding the process allowed me to give myself a simple goal that got me through to the point where I could say, I know I can control it. I know I can deal with it. I just have to get through that 20 seconds and then things are going to be, you know, manageable. So that's all right. I just wanted to finish saying that.
I didn't mention much. Really. Yeah. I mean,
no,
I
off
know,
you go. Your turn.
No, I know from this perspective, you know, I'm not in anywhere near some of the situations you have, but I've had my low moments or my low days. And I started to recognize that it was a spiral and I was going down. And I recognized if I started the day in the wrong way, by the end of the day, I could be under the turn of the desk. And so once I realized that, I kind of catch myself on the spiral. Okay, I've got to reverse that trend. I've got to start climbing out of the spiral now and stop going down the hole. So that's how I have something similar. I'm, and it can happen like, for me, it used to be like having a bad conversation with someone or a client or having a difficult conversation with a client or something that didn't go well. and it would send me into the, well, the voice and so that's where it'd end up. And I have to go, so what I have some positive things around here, or I have some feedback that someone's given me that makes me feel good. So I go and read it. No. What was just said to me is bollocks, and that's the truth. And, you know, it's more about them than me.
Yeah, 100%. And that kind of whole thing you're talking about, cyclical thoughts, I mean, that's obviously kind of something that a lot of people have, I certainly have, is that you start thinking and analysing and going through this thought process and going through a spiral. You're thinking, your analysis is to go down into this spiral. Mine is that it's a spiral that's going out of control. Mm. And what I found is if I could manage to break it for a millisecond, the spiral stops and it would start again. But every time I broke it, it would break for slightly longer.
Yep.
And after a while, you end up being able to break it for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds. After a while, you can break it for a few minutes. It takes time.
Yeah.
But the first time you kind of managed to break it for that millisecond, you say, oh, that was pretty pointless because it's just gone off again.
Yeah.
But that first millisecond is going to build to a second and a third. I mean, it's a similar idea to what I was saying before.
Yeah.
To the point to which, I mean, obviously, I think we never really truly get rid of these kind of bonkers problems we have. But
well, we're a product of our history, and we can't get. And you can't start. You can't wipe the slate and start again, can you? I mean, we're people of a certain age, and you just have to kind of like, you know, we bear the battle scars of what's gone before. So it is fascinating. So, all right. You got back to Paris. You managed to dip back to Paris. Where's the journey taken you since then?
Well, I mean, yeah, when I got back to Paris, things got a little bit, got easier in the sense that I could actually go and meet people as clients, and I'd built up a client base in France. And I now specialize in what I call brand SERPs, the search result for an exact match brand name. What comes up when somebody searches your brand name or your personal name?
Yeah.
And knowledge panels, which is a long story, which we won't get into. And as far as I know, I'm the only person who specializes in this. And it's phenomenally important for all businesses and people, is what Google shows your audience when they search your brand name. It needs to be positive, accurate, and convincing. And how I got into that is actually kind of fun, in the sense that I got back to Paris, and then I would go into these meetings with my potential clients, my prospects, and they would... I would talk to them and say, oh, I'm going to do your digital marketing. And they would say, great, wonderful. We're with you, Jace. You know, I'm quite convincing when I put my mind to it, I suppose. And then I'd walk out of the room and 50% would sign and 50% wouldn't. And I thought, 50%, that's pretty rubbish, given how enthusiastic they were. And one of the clients who did sign, I said to them, you know, I mean, like, we were talking about something, I can't remember quite what it was. And they said, oh, you know what we did? As soon as you walked out of the room, we Googled your name.
Right.
And what came up with a blue dog? It was a blue dog. And we thought that's quite fun. And then I thought, actually, if they weren't that kind of fun person.
Orientated, they wouldn't see it. Yes.
Yeah, they would say, this guy's a blue dog. He's a cartoon person and a musician. He's not looking after our digital strategy. And that's why they didn't sign. So then I thought, what do I need to do? I need to influence the results on that search result to demote the blue dog to a small portion. It's part of my story, so it needs to be there. And it's fun and it's interesting and it sets me a little bit apart from the other digital marketing experts, I think. And so I just went about making sure that result reflects me as a digital marketer today, and my credibility and authority and expertise within the digital marketing field, which it does. If you search my name, Jason Barnard, you will see Search Engine Land, Search Engine Journal, SEMrush, Twitter Boxes, Knowledge Panel, Wordlift, all these.
And blue dogs now on page two.
No, that's the point, is you get the blue dog in the Knowledge Panel. So it's on the right-hand side saying, Jason Barnard was a blue dog. So it's still there. It's just not prominent.
I'm going to park this bit because I'm interested in this bit. I'm going to park that. And I need to be careful because I will get geeked out on this because I'm a marketer too. So I need to be very careful. So I'm going to park. Right. So let's get to my questions and we're going to get back to all of that in a moment. This is going to be a long podcast. This is definitely going to be split into two because there's no way that I can paint everything that we've talked about in a normal podcast, which is fine. I'm really enjoying myself. So you're going to
have the first half is the bonkers mad person, and the second is going to be the digital marketer.
I don't know. We'll work it out. So look, what is, let's go back into, so obviously you've had the whole journey. And so what was success for you? How do you measure success?
If I'm enjoying it.
Is that it? Yeah, I guess it probably is for you.
And making enough money to pay the bills, obviously. Yeah. So no, success is making enough money to pay the bills and to provide for my family.
Yeah.
And providing it, I mean, my daughter's now doing about to do a PhD. I've been able to support her in her education. I think for me, that's very important.
Yeah.
She hasn't got big student debts. We've managed to get her to the PhD level without any debt at all.
Fantastic.
Which I'm very, very pleased about, because I think it's important from my perspective that my daughter, my family, the people who rely on me, or the people, sorry, that's not the way to say it, is it? The people around me, the people who I feel responsibility towards, can rely on me and are supported by me in the way that I think is correct. Yeah. And my daughter, obviously, she's going to go to PhD, then she's going to fly off and make her own living, and that's wonderful, and I won't have that. So that's obviously incredibly important. But the second is that I'm actually enjoying what I'm doing. And when I get up in the morning, and maybe that does come back to the whole kind of period in Mauritius, is I know what it's like to wake up in the morning and really not be able to face the day. I want to wake up in the morning. I want to think, that's a good perspective. I'm looking forward to this.
That's a good perspective, actually, isn't it? That's a fantastic perspective.
But that's what I was doing before. It was just that one period that I was thinking, oh, I can't face it. But, you know, waking up and saying, I'm going to go and play double bass in a bar in Brittany, playing punk folk music, drinking beer. What's not to look forward to?
Well, indeed. Absolutely. Perhaps not at 9 in the morning, maybe later in the day. But there we go.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Oh, so the worst thing about the touring was we would wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, having gone to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, to drive 9 hours to go to the next place to do a sound check to get ready for the gig. It was a pretty tough physical cycle.
Yeah, it was a lot of sleep, I imagine.
Pity me, please.
Absolutely, yes. My heart.
I was 22, so when you're 22, you think that's
fair. Oh dear. So, what do you see as your contribution?
I think there are 4 Barking Dogs records. I think they're positive in the sense that, you know, people still buy them and people still write to me occasionally saying, oh, I've got your album and I love it. During that period of playing gigs, we made people happy. We made a really good party atmosphere. They got drunk, they had fun, they listened to good music. And we had I think we contributed to people's musical awakening as kind of teens and early 20s. And I went to the garage in a town in the south of France, and the guy went, oh, you're Jason Bernard. I've got all your albums. On a plane. And the stewardess looked at me really weirdly, and I thought, oh, she's going to throw me off the plane. And she came up to me and said, you're Jason Bernard. I used to come and see you in concert.
That must feel really good.
It doesn't happen often, but it is. It makes you feel like you've contributed something to other people's lives without necessarily knowing them. And then the Blue Dog and Yellow Koala thing, you know, when you've got 5 million visits a month, I would estimate probably 50 million children have seen the Blue Dog and Yellow Koala. And my wife and I have affected their lives positively.
Yeah.
Grandma once wrote to us and said, I'd like to thank you because I babysit a lot for my grandchildren. They never said please and thank you. And since watching your cartoons, they say please and thank you all the time. And it was only then that I realized that we'd written please and thank you into the script we didn't actually write it in the script. So I say it so naturally that Buwa, the blue dog, says please and thank you. And I hadn't realized it all the time. And another one was a mother wrote to us and said, my son is autistic, he's 22. He can't focus on anything except your cartoon. Thank you, because you give him and me some peace.
You know, when you get those, you know you've done a good job, don't you? Those are the things that make you feel good.
And whatever happened in the end, we've got 2 music albums. They're available online. There's a TV series available online that you can watch. There are kids now watching the TV series because I've been talking about it on podcasts like this. So it's kind of awakening or communicating with a different generation of children. But then I also, I did a video on YouTube. Sorry, I'm laughing because it's really, I did a video that was talking about the five P's of content marketing and, you know, rubbish SEO advice as always from we digital marketers who think we know it all. And I did this video and then 6 months later, I found a comment of me said, "I'll bet you don't know this, but you sound just like Boo-Wa the blue dog." To which I replied, "I do know it because I am Boo-Wa the blue dog." And that was really funny. And then I visited somebody's house. It was the wife of a best friend had her niece round for dinner. And yep. I pitched up at the house, walked in the door and said, "Hello, everybody, it's me." And the niece just looked at me. Her entire face just dropped. And I said, "What's wrong?" Because I'd never met her. And she said, "But you're Boo-Wa." And it was this complete kind of like, you see it on their face and it's just this stunned moment. And you kind of think, wow, she had been watching Boo-Wa and Kuala as a child and she's now 22.
Yeah.
And she was just kind of like stunned to have this... And if you think back to your childhood memories of the programs, how would you feel if you met or you suddenly heard the voice of one of your favorite characters completely out of context, completely unexpectedly? I look at all this, I mean, you know, Rhubarb and Custard or Barber Papa or whatever it might be, or the Magic Roundabout. These are all things from our youth.
They are, absolutely, yeah.
30 years later, you still remember, and it's deeply ingrained in your being. And so I find that encouraging and pleasing and flattering, of course. I mean, I would be a liar if I didn't think it was flattering.
I have to admit, it doesn't happen very often, but it has happened where I've been somewhere and someone says to me, "Oh, you've got a podcast, haven't you? I've heard it," and they recognise me. It kind of go. Oh, yeah, it makes you stand a bit taller for a moment. Oh, yeah, I haven't I?
and that is the point, is that not only do you have a podcast, but people actually listen to it and people pay attention, which means that you're contributing to the world in a positive and public manner, which, I mean, hats off to you for that. I think that's great.
Thank you. Well, hats off to you for everything you've done. I'm really enjoying this conversation. So, look, what is the one question I haven't asked you that I should have done?
What did I do just before the show? What's happened is, it's kind of going a little bit mad. The whole COVID thing has, I was a digital nomad traveling around the world. I'd just gone right around the world from Paris to Australia to Seattle, back to Paris again. And that was when lockdown happened. So I was flying. I was literally flying, obviously, but I was on a roll of being a digital nomad, no home, living in hotels, going to conferences, and generally being a bit, how can we say it, irresponsible teenagerish at 52 years old. And then lockdown happened, and my daughter, who has a flat in Paris, kindly let me sleep behind a sofa, and I've been sleeping behind a sofa for a year. And I was talking about it to somebody else the other day, and it occurred to me that I'm so optimistic and naive that I just kept thinking it's going to start again. So I just didn't bother finding a new flat or anything. And every couple of weeks, I'd kind of think, no, it's not. And then I'd build it back up again. So I would keep planning to move or to travel a couple of weeks ahead. And I spent a year, or probably most of us did, in fact, or 9 months in denial. And then Joost de Valk from Joost Plugin fame, wanted to work with me on their knowledge graph and panel on the aspect of Google understanding, which is what I do with the knowledge panels.
Yeah.
And I'd been working ad hoc for clients for years on this, basically traveling around the world, doing ad hoc work, helping clients with their brand SERPs and their knowledge panels in Google. And then when I started working with Joost, I thought, actually, he's really intelligent. He really knows what he's talking about. I have to up my game. I have to be up to the mark because I'm working with somebody for whom I have enormous respect.
Yeah.
And so I started kind of digging around, because one thing is I delivered some work and he said, "Oh, but what about this and what about that?" And I thought, oh, that wasn't up to the mark, was it? So I then built a machine to start kind of helping me do it so that I could do better work, and then realized that in fact it's now becoming a SaaS platform called CaliCube Pro that helps you with your brand SERP. The SERP is search engine results page, what appears when somebody Googles your brand name, but also the knowledge panel, what Google puts on the right-hand side on desktop, where it's showing what it thinks is fact about you. And obviously when Google is showing fact, people believe it. So if it's incorrect, it's really dangerous for you. You need to start controlling what Google has understood about you, because we're in a world now where Google understands the world a little bit like a human being, obviously not as well, but you know, the problem as well is called Google's got a brilliant memory. So if it gets it wrong today,
I heard it somewhere said that whenever you do a search, that search, when you push the button on a search, there's something like 70,000 different data points have been worked at that moment in time.
Wow. Okay. That sounds very probable. It might. Yeah. Wow.
Because
anyway,
they've got access to everything you've ever done. So they can see what you've just done. You've clicked that thing. And so I guess in my case, I do a lot of running and I'm now looking for a running watch. And, you know, you can just imagine like, oh yeah, he's been running. So he's a serious contender for a running watch. You can see, I can see that I'm going to start seeing running watch adverts for the next of the year now.
Right. And of course, the important thing then is if it's understood who offers the running watch that might potentially be a match for you, they, with things like Google Discover, they can start pushing that towards you without you even having to ask for it.
Yeah, and they know I'm a serious contender because I'm a runner, because they've got my data that I've been running for the last 2 or 3 years.
No, 100%. So kind of from a human personal point of view, we're all starting to get used to that idea. But then you look at it from the point of view of a marketer and you say, if Google can understand what it is I have to offer, it makes it possible for it to match it to the person who's looking for it. Yeah. And until it's understood that, it cannot do that match or make that match. So this understanding is phenomenally important. That's what CaliCube's all about. And to come back to my little story, I started then developing this CaliCube SaaS platform, which is aimed at helping people, because I needed to up my game for Yoast. And I've just spent the last week, I'm about to launch it as beta, and I'm getting 3 requests a day for people who want to be on the beta program. And I haven't done any advertising because I think it's interesting and it's important, and people are starting to realize it's important. But the problem, of course, is that I've built the platform myself.
Ah.
So now I have to lie in the bed that I made. I'm managing the database, and I've just actually spent yesterday and this afternoon making the database faster, because if I get all these people on the platform, the database isn't good enough. It's all going to fall apart and I'm going to look a complete fool.
Oh, well, the life of a techie.
Well, and that's it. It's a techie who's creative and was a blue dog and a punk folk musician. So that kind of categorization is something as well. It's something that human beings have problems with. Google has an incredible problem with multifacetedness, the fact that you're a podcaster and a marketer. That's quite difficult for Google to understand. That's quite difficult for a lot of people to understand. So once you get that multifacetedness, we're moving into a territory that's going to get phenomenally interesting, because it's so difficult for a machine to understand. A machine being binary, multifacetedness makes it's obviously a problem. Yeah. Sorry, go
ahead. I mean, Google is not intelligent. It literally is doing it by number crunching, isn't it? It literally is doing it by sheer brute force connections. It doesn't have the capacity to kind of see connections as we do.
No, they're trying to work towards it with artificial intelligence. But yeah, that kind of brute force idea still is very much the dominant part.
I'm becoming to realize that artificial intelligence will never happen in that. It'll never happen in its own right. It'll always have the human structure behind it.
Yeah, I think we have to hope it stays like that, because if it doesn't have the human structure behind it, and it does.
Well, we've all seen the films, haven't we? We all know where that leads.
Brilliant. Absolutely wonderful.
Oh, dear. So, look, this is your bit. I mean, you've alluded to what you do. What are you looking to do? What do you want for people to come to you? Who do you want to talk to? How do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean,
are you still in a record deal?
No, I actually started making a record with a guy in Manchester. We're trying to do it where he records in his house. he sends me the file, I record it, and then we send it off to the mixing guy in Ireland, trying to make a record, a remote record, which would be cool. So we've started. We're in the process of doing it, and it might or might not become a reality.
Keep in touch. I will definitely want to do a short cast on that one if you get it off the ground.
He's a brilliant guitarist. He's a really nice guy. He plays finger picking guitar incredibly well, and he's a lovely, lovely chap. And I said to him, "Oh, I'd like to work, maybe make a record with you." He said, "Oh, you should talk to my brother. He's much better than I am." And he showed me a video of his brother, who is a phenomenally good guitarist. But the brother plays incredibly clean, really, really correct, perfect music. Whereas my mate Nig plays finger picking, bit ad hoc, bit off, but he's got soul. And I think that's, for me, I'd like to end on soul. Nig's got soul. He's not maybe as good as his brother technically, but he's got boatloads of soul that his brother simply doesn't have.
That's what makes it sound. That's what.
Yeah. And I think kind of through, you were saying what motivates me and what makes me get up in the morning. And I'm a believer that I'm not religious in any way, manner or form, but we have something in us that makes us tick, that represents our innermost being, is a soul. And it's, let's call it a soul. It's not a thing, but that's where all my motivation, all my desire, everything I do comes from that kind of hippie soul of, I don't know, but and the thing about the Mauritius period is I felt that somebody had ripped out my soul and I didn't have one. And I had to rebuild it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's a lovely, 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 I mean, it was difficult, but you know, I feel so happy that I got my soul back, and it's all. This sounds like some awful kid story, but you know, I got my soul back, and I'm really happy about it. So, if you do want to reach out to me, Twitter, LinkedIn, search my name, Jason Bernard, on Google. If you want to work with Calicube Pro platform, it's all about making your brand SERP, what appears when somebody searches your brand name, better, positive, accurate, and convincing.
What kind of companies are you looking for?
We've got some clients, but I'm looking to work with agencies who want to upsell this or sell this onto their clients, because what I realize is it's actually, although very simple as a concept, working on it is actually, it's quite a difficult thing to get your head around. And so when I've tried to explain it to clients directly, it's a lot of time and it's very time consuming and difficult, and they don't really get it. But when you talk to a digital marketer or marketer and you talk about Google entities, getting Google to understand, leveraging those results, the results you like, pushing them up above the results you don't like on your brand SERP, trying to get the video boxes, the Twitter boxes, all of that makes sense to a marketer. And they can see that all of that plays into an overall global, intelligent digital marketing strategy.
Yeah.
And that everything you're doing for your brand SERP is going to serve the rest of your digital strategy if you do it well.
Yeah.
And a digital marketer will see that, and a client directly often won't. So I would much rather give that message to an agency and let them go on and build that into, bake it into their overall strategy for their clients.
Yeah. It sounds like a good plan.
It's a good plan. Will it work out? That's the question.
It's all part of the journey, and if it don't work, something else will come in that does work. That's how it happens.
Thank you very much. That's perfect. It's all part of the journey. I'm going to have that on my brain for the next few days.
Oh, that's it, really. It's all part of the journey. So all those links for you, any more links that I need to put on the site? I mean, I've got your links. They will all be on the site and on the show notes. You can find everything there. But you know, if you want to Google Jason Barnard, you will clearly find him. Because if you can't, he ain't doing his job right.
Oh dear, yeah, that's put me on the spot. Yeah.
The final question I ask everybody, which is the big question, is what's the meaning of life for you?
Keep your soul. Good tip. Basically, be true to yourself. It's being true to who you really are. I mean, once again, it sounds like some awful kid's story from Disney, but having lost my soul and rebuilt it, I know how phenomenally difficult it is to build a soul in inverted commas or get a soul back. And the panic I felt when I thought I'd lost it is something I can't describe. So keep it, don't lose it, hang on to it because it is your life's blood.
Well, still, very clearly, in the way you lived your life, your soul was very much part of you, and it was what you brought out, because the music, the creativity, everything you've done was about that, was about expressing that in the world. And I can understand the journey you went through when it was taken away from you. So thank you so much for sharing that story with us. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you. I've really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, I'm glad you have. I enjoyed it too. It was great. I shared some things I don't usually share, so that's always an interesting experience.
So thank you so much for being so candid with us.
Yeah, well, when I have choky moments, when my little tears are coming out of my little eyes, it means I'm telling something that's very dear to my
heart. Very precious. Well, thank you for sharing those moments with us. And
Jason Barnard,
all the best and thank you. Speak soon.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was delightful.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Jason Barnard. If you'd like to catch up with Jason, you can find him at jasonbarnard.com. You can find all his stuff there, his music, his podcast, his history, and and it's a lovely website, so do check that one out. You can also find him on Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Facebook. And those links are available at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com. And while you're there, check out the resources tab and pick up the 5 questions worksheet. It's just a quick reminder to check out the shortcast. They drop every single Sunday. This last weekend was about contribution. Shortcasts are 5 to 10 minutes, me exploring something that I thought about this week, or a tool or something that I've discovered. Well worth checking out. And that's it for this week. So if you are enjoying this podcast, if you're enjoying any podcast, do make sure you support your content creators with likes, shares, and better still, comments, because comments and reviews are the lifeblood of our industry. And that's it from me, and thank you so much for your time and attention. I'll catch you next time. All the best.